The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website MerckResearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to MerckResearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now, on to today's episode. Leo Schmidt, you are the CIO of River Eddy Capital Management, a hedge fund in New York. You may no longer be in New York City, or maybe just not for the time being, but you have a lot of views that are certainly contrarian, and especially in this day and age where we hear a lot about electric vehicles and about sustainability and about this idea that fossil fuels are a thing of the past, and oil majors and companies that do a lot of pollution and that consume a lot of fossil fuels are not a good place for investors to put their money. But your views run counter to this. In fact, you told me right before that you view energy, and we can talk about specifically what you mean with this, was one of the easier slam dunks of the current environment. So walk me through that a little bit and your views on the energy sector.
So let's start with the near term.
Yeah.
And then we can look at longer term. So near term, oil and gas currently are priced higher than they were at the start of the pandemic. But we have actually less demand still. So the supply and demand imbalance, as the pandemic eases, demand is certainly going to ramp up, but supply will have a lag. And so there will be a supply-demand imbalance, which will push the supply, the price of oil and gas up. It has to happen.
Okay.
So the question then, how long does that last?
Right.
Well, supply has come offline all through this pandemic. You know, it crashed and burned. In fact, yesterday we saw Saudi Arabia was beginning to ramp up a little bit. I'm sure that will help some, but the big countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia have government needs to keep their countries afloat, in essence. In the United States, we all have become the swing producer of natural gas, and we are driven by the price of oil. So when the price of oil is economic to produce, we produce. When it's not, we shut down. So we've shut it a lot all through this past year. And now to bring that demand back on would take time. And I'm pretty sure a lot of people are going to be cautious after having a near-death experience all year long before they start ramping up production. They're not going to get ahead of the demand.
Right.
So as that ramps up, how fast can it be brought back online? And, you know, how fast does demand ramp up? So that, right, again, becomes, you know, a bit of a question of what's happening with the pandemic.
Right.
How fast do we come back online? Mm. We can talk about that a little later, but I generally think we could come back pretty quickly, but it depends upon government officials and how we manage our way through this.
Right. Okay. But let's go back to the energy real quick now.
Okay. Yep.
So we're talking about the price of the raw, the raw materials, oil and gas and such, which, as you say, is very much dependent on supply and demand. Where do the companies, the stocks, sit in that equation?
So
you can tell
they are below their pricing where they were
right
at the beginning of the pandemic. They all have generally okay cash flow, mm-hmm, although it depends on how much exploration, but you've been doing in production, capital spending. Again, they've all gone through near-death experiences, but you can go up and down the chain. So Schlumberger and Halliburton, some of these other the equipment suppliers and oil field services, they all have gone through near-death experiences, mm, and they're some of the largest companies in the world, and so right, they have an ability to ramp down their capital spending. All have done that.
Mm-hmm.
And so as they ramp, and ramping that up will take time.
Mm.
But they throw off cash right now. This is the mm-hmm point where they throw off a tremendous amount of cash.
Mm-hmm.
There is, if you want to be risky, you can find those names that really came close to death. That mm. Or you can just find a nice, an oil and gas company that doesn't throws off a lot of cash right now, and isn't spending, and they don't have a lot of debt. If you want to play a little other more risky ideas, you can do some of the pipelines, the gas pipelines, because no matter what you think about the price of natural gas, it needs to be moved.
Okay.
And we have the cheapest natural gas in the world, except for Saudi Arabia, and we're not far behind. So that gas will be moved. And ideally, you'll find pipelines that take it to a liquid natural gas outlet. So, and then if you find basins that have been trapped, so like there's a lot of natural gas in the Utica and Marcellus Shale. And if you can move that to the East Coast, and there's some pipelines being built that will allow you to get to an LNG port and export it to the rest of the world, that's almost a slam dunk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a name, Equitrans, that's ETRN is the ticker. Risky name, a lot of debt. They're in the middle of building. They had a issue with getting permits through the Appalachian Trail. And there was a family feud between the Parks Department. Forestry gave permission, National Park said no. So you had a fight. They had a lawsuit. They can build through the trail. So that becomes kind of an interesting name, because as they build a pipeline through the Appalachians to the East Coast, and then you can start exporting natural gas, and they have reservoirs and basins where they're collecting gas. That's a pretty cool name.
Cool,
it has risk, but because you have the pipeline isn't done, but it's close to being done. So you you have to take a leap of faith and say, what could that be? But there's other names like that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to look in natural gas, pipelines are a great way to go. The problem with a lot of pipelines is we had MLPs,
right,
structures, and that MLP structure is going away because tax advantages have gone away, although they may come back. But with the Trump tax change, when you brought down the corporate tax rate, the MLP structure became less attractive.
Okay.
So people are reversing out of that. So they've created these MLP structures that are very complex, hard to unravel. Uh-huh. But if you look around, you can find some ideas. So that's another thought.
And ETRN is not an MLP, right?
It was an MLP, but now it is, it's not. They reversed the structure.
Interesting. Now, this is pretty contrarian, because this was one of the companies that Morgan Stanley, last month, they came out with a paper here on, this is after the Biden administration's unveiled their energy policies, And they came up with a, you know, a list of companies that, that could potentially gain and some that can, could potentially lose. And they saw, they said that ETRN Equitrans was most negatively exposed to regulatory risk. This is because of the their major pipeline.
The pipeline going through the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah, mostly due to that. So what's going on there now? They had to...
So they had a family feud between the Park Service and the forestry. Right. Uh-huh. And so the Appalachian Trail is, well, the forest around it is managed by the Forestry Service, and the trail is managed by the national parks. Uh-huh. And so there's a fight, and the pipeline won basically in short, in courts. Now they're being challenged, but I have a hard time. Yes, it could end. Could it? The bigger issue probably is a delay. But
yeah, you don't think it's going to be scuttled altogether, because that's
It'll be scuttled.
Uh-huh.
It's one of those things that it's almost too important on a national basis.
Really?
Because, okay. I mean, we've shot ourselves in the foot before, but it's in many ways this is a legal issue with who has control of what.
Mm.
So, I think it's pretty intriguing, and you know, again, it's a high risk name. I'm not putting too much of my portfolio there, but it's enough that when it works, and then it will pay, you know, consistent dividends once they're on.
Yeah, the dividend presently is right around 8%.
Yep,
which is pretty high. Now,
so it's given your entry price, that's a pretty good price to wait for something that could have a nice upside.
Yeah. And it wasn't there was some other sell side. Barclays just downgraded it. Actually, they say that in light of regulatory headwinds to the Mountain Valley pipeline project and a markedly less friendly backdrop for oil and gas infrastructure under the Biden administration, we have become less certain that the project will cross the finish line. And until the project is completed or outcome assured, we expect shares of ETRN to underperform.
Yep.
That was back on February 11th. Right. So this is very much it wouldn't be the first time that the sell side is wrong.
Yep. They can't afford to take that kind of risk, right? Because if you make that call and you blow it. So, but a small amount of your portfolio, the upside is more than a double.
Mm. Very interesting.
And so and the pipeline, you know, it's hard to understand where they are, because I listened to the February call and I read through what was happening. We don't know where it's at because we're in the middle of the winter. It's snowing, it's freezing, but they've started work again, and so that work will likely be completed around June.
Uh-huh.
So the Biden administration, they got to stop it soon.
Right. If they're going to stop it.
I think once you're through the Appalachian Mountains and the trail, the rest of it is pretty much already completed.
Uh-huh.
So I don't want to oversell this name, but it's a name that I find kind of intriguing. And there's pipelines like that. And again, liquid natural gas, the United States has over 100 years of reserves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's pretty interesting. And it's a, once the pipeline's there, it's a consistent, solid cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And going back to what I said at the beginning, the secular argument to invest away from fossil fuels and, you know, all this electric car stuff. I mean, you have the Biden administration saying all these things and electric cars and ESG and all these other things. But you still see that there's still a case that we need a fossil fuels, oil companies and all these other things.
Right. So we cannot produce enough electric vehicles simply because we don't have enough lithium.
Yeah.
As much as you want to like take every car out and make it an electric vehicle, we can't. There are other battery technologies, but we don't have them currently to manufacture.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not ready for prime time yet. The big question is, will we slow down the demand or fossil fuels, you know, so that it makes no sense to invest in these companies? It's not the developing world that's going to be the new demand. It's going to be the emerging markets. And they want to have the lifestyles that we have.
Mm.
And for them to get there, they have to have fossil fuels. There's just no way that they can, you know, develop a country without fossil fuels. And if the problem with a lot of what we call sustainable, so solar, wind, is that they are intermittent. So what's happening now in Texas is a good example of intermittency. You just, you know, you can't rely on the weather or sun or wind to be permanent. So you have to have backup plants, peaking plants, which are generally natural gas. And so you have to have them. That's just the way, even to have an electric grid, all electric, you know, vehicles, you still have to have natural gas and other fossil fuels as a backup. You have to have them. And as you grow into the developing world, it's, you know, the demand is will be high, you know, especially airplanes and other vehicles. Now, that doesn't mean we can't have certain types of things like, you know, electric fleets that come and go around every night. Natural gas is a great electric fleet, you know, because we don't have natural gas refueling stations, but it's the cleanest fossil fuel you can get. But there's just tremendous amount of development that's going to happen in the emerging world, and they have to have fossil fuel, you know, fossil fuels. You just can't get there any other way. And we, as a developed culture, we want to have reliable energy, and we can't have that without fossil fuels.
Right.
So, and then the biggest issue is if you can't have storage. So lithium is pretty much the one way we want to do. Lithium, I'm surprised that the green movement likes lithium, because lithium wastes are pretty toxic. And yes, you get rid of carbon, but you have this horrible waste. So you're creating pollution. We could do that with nuclear. You know, nuclear waste, they're pretty bad, toxic, but, you know, you have a lot of energy. And carbon-free. We don't want that. So I'm surprised people are willing to make that trade. But there's a lot of places where people have made silly bets. And you have Elon Musk making, you know, a lot of people feel comfortable with electric vehicles. But he's it's his own company, selling his, talking his own book.
Oh, of course.
You know, yeah. So, yes, the go fast, cool cars. Are they going to be right for everybody? No. So, and then again, if you look at the emerging world, electric vehicles are expensive. So people who live in emerging markets, they don't have that kind of money. So it's the demand for oil and gas is going to be there. It's not for just transportation, for shipping, for airplanes, all those things are going to have a demand for gas. Any way you look at it, it's not going to go away for a number of years. And you can't get rid of all the existing infrastructure overnight. So all that just means demand for oil and gas. And the big question is, what's the price? And so the United States has become the swing producer. And so as a swing producer, we've created an economic reason to be there. So we no longer rely on Saudi Arabia and Russia, because we change, we call the price natural gas. And strategically in the world, that makes a big difference in the world. And it's changed political dynamics too. But
yeah,
not going to go away.
Right. Okay. What about this whole thing in Texas? You touched on it earlier. Do you see any obvious winners from that?
Yeah. Ted Cruz is a loser because he
looks that way.
California.
What does he carry? He's down in Cancun, right?
Yeah. So who knows? Any obvious winner and loser? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? But you know, what it shows, I think, is the idea. I mean, it's topical, but you know, California is having some of the same issues that, you know, you can't have intermittent supply is really hard for an advanced economy. And that's the problem. You have to be able to switch quickly. And, you know, that ability to have a cushion is what creates, you know, the electric grid has to be balanced. So
yeah.
I don't know, maybe if you want to make an interesting bet, it would be on long distance power supplies, and that we're going to create, at once upon a time, they were thinking about creating a super highway throughout the whole United States where we could bounce electrons all the way around. We now have, you know, these like the PJM and all sorts of other legal areas where you, you know, buy and sell electricity, but you could conceivable have like a super highway where you go around through the whole country. Maybe that happens. Who knows?
That sounds like it'll be a pretty ambitious infrastructure project though.
Yep. They were talking about that 20 years ago.
So. They were. Okay. Yeah. I mean, a lot of things aren't new. We talked about this also. And if we look at the general market, and we like to use historical parallels, of course, perhaps the most popular one these days is 1999. We see these tech stocks going to the moon. We see these, you know, being bid up at to ridiculous levels that have nothing to do with fundamentals. We see, you know, in crazy risk appetite.
for investors, retail investors entering the fray, re-entering the fray, because they were many of them gone for a while. And so where do you view that, if we had to, obviously with a caveat that nothing is exactly the same ever, but what do you think is the most apt historical parallel here as we record this in February 2021?
Thank you for putting me on record for what I always make a prediction, never say when. Or if you say you have a prediction, never say when.
Exactly.
If you say when, not what it's going to be. So we talked a little bit about this. And one of the things I think is a great quote, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So what's the rhyme?
You said that, by the way, do you?
I have no idea.
Me neither. We'll have to look it up. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
Anyway, so what's the rhyme? What's the poetry right now? So, you know, you brought up a good analogy, 1999, and it has a lot of feels like that. We have tech stocks, high, big cap, tech stocks going through the roof. We have retail jumping in. People, you know, buying things like GameStop is a great, you know, sign that we're near the top, because we have, you know, people buying a company that's going bankrupt and saying you can buy and hold it to punish a hedge fund is stupid. Mm. Yeah, you're going to buy and hold it till it goes bankrupt? Anyway, so that kind of retail froth is there. You know, we have other names like Shopify, which is, you know, hot company. It's taken on Amazon. Amazon is a kind of a, you know, the retail, you know, juggernaut. And Shopify is having a way for smaller retailers to take them on. But, you know, Shopify has a, you know, price to sales ratio that's through the roof. And the company's got cool technology, but it ain't run that well. Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of a sleepy little, like, Canadian company singing Kumbaya, and they're just feeling lucky. So, you know, how do we, you know, so we're in a silly phase of investing. And the question is, when does that end? You could also say, you know, this is different, you know, so we have financial stimulation like we had at the end of the great financial crisis,
right?
Like 2008. So you can say that's the model.
Right.
But things are different this time than then. And the big difference is the financial system. So banks were going under.
Right
now, banks are in pretty good shape. Right. I mean, they have their issues. I mean, you have, you know, credit, commercial real estate is, you know, falling off a cliff. You have a lot of people who are behind in the mortgage payments, but because they have a forbearance, you're not seeing it.
Right.
The banks have taken tremendous amount of reserves. So they're well reserved for all this.
Yeah.
They can see the numbers, even though we may not see the cash flow. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's a difference. And one of the other big differences, and this is the thing that I'm wrestling with, and I'm not the only one. So in 2008, 2009, 10, you know, we had the Fed put in a lot of money, and people felt there was going to be inflation, and there wasn't. And there's a good reason for that, because people were hoarding cash. Uh-huh. So as much money as you put into that, we didn't spend it. So there's a thing called the velocity of money, which I pay a lot of attention to. So it's, if you had Irving Fisher had an equation back in the 1920s, and it's MV equals PQ, which is basically say, the money supply times velocity equals the nominal GDP growth. So if the velocity of money is going down, you can put a lot of money into it and it won't change the price level, which is what happened for us after the great financial crisis.
Right.
It's different this time. So what's different? So the banks have pretty good balance sheets. They're not trying to repair them. And so what happened in the great financial crisis is the Federal Reserve put a lot of money into the system. The banks took it, and then they deposited it back at the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve had an asset go up, and then they had a liability go up from the banks, increasing their reserves. And the banks then had a nice long-term spread business. They borrowed cheap, you know, from their depositors and gave it back to the Fed. And then they could buy assets from the Fed, you know, an asset and still be getting money. So it was an easy trade for them. This time, banks are going to be lending more. And they're right now beginning to take money that they had deposited at the Fed, the reserves that they kept at the Fed, they're taking that out and spending it. And you're having the federal government having fiscal policy, which we did not do in the great financial crisis, also spending.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of liquidity that's coming into the system that probably will be spent, but that's a probable, not for certain. So people have been hoarding cash through the pandemic. And so they've been paying off credit cards, savings rate has gone up. Mm-hmm. But the question is, how fast do we come out of this? So do we come out of this rip-roaring? So like the, in the great financial crisis, we grew at like a 3%. We didn't have any big 8% quarters, 10% growth quarters in a row. We should have had a whole bunch of them. We didn't. So the unemployment rate went down slowly. This time, how do we come out of it? Does the unemployment rate drop like a rock, or do we slowly chip away at it like we did in the great financial crisis? Given the amount of government spending and the nature of the crisis, that it's a pandemic. So once we have the all clear, I mean, I think young people are going to be partying in the streets. I mean, New York City is going to be one big discotheque, I expect. You know?
If anybody's left, yeah.
Well, if you're under 20, 30, you don't have a problem. It's my age. I'm the people who are dropping dead, you know, so.
Well, not quite yet there, Leo. I mean,
I try to be healthy. I mean, I walk 2 to 4 miles, but yeah. So, but it's the young and how that happens. How do they come out and start spending? And I think, you know, like travel, there's a huge pent up demand. So it's one of the names we talked about earlier, the idea of, you know, aircraft leasing companies and, you know, the airlines.
Yeah.
I think they're fantastic ideas.
Okay. Okay.
Because there's pent up demand. It's gigantic.
Yeah.
I mean, we're tired of sitting at home.
Any favorites there?
Well, I sent you something the other day about some of the aircraft leasing companies. Now, that I did this, that slide deck was back in this in the summer. So we're now kind of, we've changed. So one of the things, the markets have changed, the change in the wind in the air. So this again is, you know, it's definitely different right at the moment than it was in the summer. We have a slope in the yield curve. We're above 1%.
Right.
1.3, I think, this morning, maybe 1.33, I don't know. Anyways, and we have small cap stocks that are beginning to really percolate. Mm. You know, from the, there was a bottom in September, then we had another one in November. And since then, you know, small cap has been a rocket. So it's a different world. And so some of these names, like I was mentioning, AerCap and Air Leasing have taken off. They're up 40%. They have more to run. Certainly some of the airlines have more to run, Delta, JetBlue, of course, Southwest, United and American are okay. American Airlines has so much debt. I mean, they have enough cash to survive if you model out their cash flows, but it's nip and tuck. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's, you know, those three I mentioned, they're going to survive. They're going to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those are great ideas. But then I particularly like the aircraft leasing companies.
Right.
Let me give you, because they got hurt worse than the airlines. And so they have a different perspective. So they got all lumped into the same and the people said, oh, it's a financial business. And so I don't want to look at this, it's a problem. Well, the difference is that aircraft leasing, even though you might suspend your lease payments, you're still on the hook for them. So the aircraft companies have to get made current, where aircraft travel, travel for the airlines, that demand is gone.
Right.
You might double up and take, you know, twice as many trips, but can you do as much as you would have done if you didn't have this? It's like getting a haircut, you know. Once you can't cut your hair, are you going to cut it twice as often, you know, twice a week instead of once a month? I mean, there's a certain amount of travel that you can't, that's forever gone. Where the lease payments, they still have to make them.
Right.
And so that cash flow, unless the aircraft company goes bankrupt, the airline company goes bankrupt, you will get that payment. Now, if it does go bankrupt, there's a bunch of things that will happen. So the air leasing companies are able to repossess the aircraft, and they're very good at that.
These are asset-backed loans?
These are asset-backed loans backed by the aircraft.
Yeah.
And the aircraft has a lot of value. And one of the things that will begin to happen is, you know, that's a good segue to what's happening with the manufacturer. So the aircraft leasing companies, they use their balance sheet to buy the aircraft. They're the biggest purchasers of aircraft.
Okay.
So Boeing and Airbus, they're their biggest customer. Boeing and Airbus are not going to push these guys into bankruptcy because they have all these back orders. But does it serve them to force them to buy an aircraft that pushes them into bankruptcy? No, they're not going to do that.
Right.
So you have to understand who has the risk. And the airline companies, they don't have the balance sheets to buy the aircraft. So they're going to need to be able to have somebody buy these aircraft, and then they're going to lease them. And in fact, they may be wanting to sell aircraft to get it off their balance sheet because they need cash.
Right.
So the aircraft leasing company has the expertise, which banks and other companies don't, because one of the big expertise is to be able to repossess the aircraft, to know where they are. And then the big thing is the gray market between buying and selling, knowing where the best markets are, what is the price differential between them.
Uh-huh.
And because they have the expertise of buying and selling aircraft in different markets, especially the secondary market, the aftermarket, is the sale of the aircraft is key to making profit on these.
Okay. So walk me through this real quick. How these aircraft leasing companies work. So you are they basically like the GMAC of the aircraft world? So they're the ones that buy. So as you said, they put out the cash to buy the aircraft from Boeing and Airbus
every major airline pretty much in the world.
Okay.
And so especially, Air Leasing has, the majority of their 5% of their fleet is in the U.S.
Okay.
The rest of the fleet is outside of the U.S. I believe it's 75% is in a flagged carrier. That means it's either owned by the government or it's like Lufthansa or Aer Lingus. It's a national airline. It's a national asset. So the country itself will not let them go bankrupt. So like we lent money to the airlines in the pandemic, the local governments are going to be lending to these companies to keep them afloat.
Yeah. All right. Although there have been examples of national airlines going bankrupt, Swiss Air, I remember.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's a good bet for government, but, most nations feel it is.
Mm.
So, and then if you do go bankrupt and you don't make your lease payments, they get repossessed and these aircraft have value. Now, is the value of the aircraft the same as it was, before the pandemic in February of 2020? No. But, we haven't had a lot of new aircraft. And as the demand comes back, I suspect the demand will come back fast, just like it did after 9/11 when nobody wanted to fly. I was one of the few people flying.
Uh-huh.
And, we'll come back.
Right on. All right. So do you have some favorite stocks or any favorite of these air leasing companies?
I gave you two, AerCap and Air Leasing. They're the biggest.
AerCap is AER. Yeah. And what's Air Leasing?
Air Leasing, AL.
AL, right. Okay.
No, they've jumped. I mean, when I was writing about them, the book value was so far below the purchase price. I mean, the current book, it was like 60% of the
book.
And the book value is basically the aircraft. And since they almost always sell the aircraft at a gain, you can pretty much guess that the book value is a solid. It's one of the few times book value works.
Interesting.
So if you want to get another little out of consensus play, this time it's a little more techie.
Okay.
So Nokia.
Yes, I remember them.
Yep. Everybody used to have their little cool phones, right?
So,
and Ericsson. So this is a play on 5G.
Uh-huh.
So 5G will be the play of Internet of Things. So it's the next generation. There's only three companies, actually four. The fourth company was very small, Samsung. They have technology. They could certainly become a player, but it's not their focus now. Nokia, Ericsson, and then Huawei, which is a Chinese company. But Huawei has been banned from the United States and Europe is considering it. And not to get, into any kind of China bashing, I suspect that Huawei will have a difficult time getting into the United States, Australia, and certainly parts of Europe have reconsidered. So that leaves two players. I mean, you have an oligopoly to begin with. And if you take out, the third big player, you're down to a duopoly. And, the thing about 5G as a technology is it's layered on top of the existing technologies. So if you think about it as kind of concentric circles that keep getting bigger and bigger, right? like the Russian babushka dolls. You keep on taking one out. This.
Yeah, yeah.
So the widest band will be the existing technology. So you have a very long range radio signal that will get you in and out. Then you have a smaller band, you know, in a smaller circle that is probably a little better technology, but you have faster rate, faster throughput. And then the smaller circle will be really the 5G millimeter wave, which will have very high throughput, very, you know, a lot of it's, but you will have a very short distance.
Okay.
So it's physics that, you know, when you have a certain amount of energy, the wave can either be wide and short or narrow and long.
Okay. Just so what did Nokia and Ericsson do for 5G?
So they make 5G. they make all the 5G infrastructure and radio.
Oh, they do.
Right. So it's called RAN or radio access network.
I see.
So the Internet of Things will have to be run through 5G. So when you have your thermostat and you want to adjust it and you're coming to your country house and turn it up, your thermostat will connect to, you know, through your Wi-Fi network, but there'll be other things that just connect, you know, like your car will be connected to a network. So that Internet of Things idea has to use 5G.
Right.
And 5G is the next wave. Uh-huh. And it will create, you know, like if you have you want to stream a lot of video in a football stadium, it will all be used.
Sure, 5G. Sure.
So that next wave of things is happening now, and Nokia and Ericsson build all the radio networks that you rely on. So it's
very cool.
Called RAN, Random Radio Access Network. Nokia had a misstep about a year and a half ago in the fall of 2019. Stock got down to like $2.50, $2, under $3, $2.50, $3. I picked it up then. It was one of the stocks that ran with GameStop.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they had a big spike here back in. That's right. I remember this, right? Earlier this month. Yeah.
Yeah, I made a mistake. I should have, when I saw, I didn't move fast enough. When I saw it, I put an order and said, I'll catch it on another. Uh-huh. And buy it back later, but I didn't. But I'm holding it. I'm going to own it because it has a lot of run. It has a tremendous amount of cash.
Right.
And they generate cash because they have a lot of patents. They have about 500 million euros a year of patent revenue. So they have a tremendous amount of cash flow just from their patents, which is for the 4G network and all the other legacy.
The
4G network, I was getting about these circles, you have to have that 4G network to put the 5G network on, and it has to work interoperably. You have to have, it's the software that will allow to pass the signals back and forth. And so you need a pretty good expertise in the old 4G network. So all your legacy systems will be using 4G, and your networks that you've sold to whoever will be the part of that play. I mean, you know how to make your network better than somebody else.
Great.
Interestingly, Nokia is the only one out of those three I was telling you that has supplied in the United States all the legacy carrier.
Uh-huh.
So they're like the go-to church.
Interesting.
So I mean, who knows? I mean, I think there'll be probably, you know, it's a name that will have has a long runway. They generate a lot of cash. They have almost the same amount of cash as they do debt.
Nice.
So they have a large amount of debt, but they have a large amount of cash. The misstep back in the fall of 2019 was all about they had acquired Alcatel-Lucent, and so they were integrating it, lost the ball. Well, they did the 4G, 5G technology. They didn't integrate it onto a chip, so it was economic.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're putting it onto one chip. There are laggards in putting it. The technology works, but the cost advantage of putting it, instead of having two components onto one component, it's much cheaper to manufacture. But get caught up. The technology works. The one of three players, they have to be here.
So, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. So that's a technology play that I like.
Nice. All right. So we got three ideas here from Leo Schmidt. First of all, I forgot what it was, right? Energy.
Energy, air leasing.
Air leasing and
Nokia.
Technology. Nokia.
Technology,
and
yeah.
Very cool. All right. Why don't we, this seems like a good time to take a break.
Sounds good.
So why don't we do that? If you are a premium subscriber, you will not get the break. So do not touch the dial. If you are not a premium subscriber and want to become one, you can sign up at the website contrarian.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H, and get a bunch of really cool benefits, including a new daily Contrarian podcast that I just started rolling out that will be in your inboxes by around 7 or so a.m. every market morning. So that's contrarian.supercast.tech.
I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarized the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website MerckResearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We're on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
All right, Leo Schmidt, River Eddy Capital Management. Thank you again for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. By the way, to rewind real quick, that quote about the past doesn't always repeat itself, it rhymes, came from the same individual who said that the coldest winter he ever spent was the summer he spent in San Francisco. Mark Twain was his name. Which I should have known, but you know, whatever. When in doubt, you can either attribute things to Mark Twain or to Winston Churchill, I have found. Anyway.
It works pretty good. Yeah.
I wonder how many, especially in Churchill's case, how many of those things he actually said. Probably not all that many, but that's another topic for another day. All right. This is the section of the show where we get to know the guest a little bit better, ask him about his background, how he came to investing in the first place, and this current stage of his career. So why don't you take us away and talk to us a little bit about that?
So let me give you, let's see. Let's start with, so I used to be at the Chubb Corporation.
Right.
And I helped manage their equity portfolio. It was a $2 billion portfolio out of a $45 billion total company assets. We had a very good track record. We had almost 300 basis points versus the S&P 500 over 10 years. So it's a nice track record. We had about 70, 80 stocks in that. And so I'm a generalist. I looked at anything and everything. One of the special sauces for that portfolio was we were an all cap. So while we would have giant companies and we'd buy them well, the special sauce was having 30 to 40 names that would be small cap. And that's where we would get a lot of our performance.
Mm-hmm.
It taught me also to be understanding the liquidity names. So if you're an insurance company, you always have to be aware that you may need to sell something in a short time. What I did before I started River Eddy. We were acquired. Chubb was acquired by Ace.
Right.
And they threw out the investment department. It was disappointing. But I had all my deferred comp come forward. And in essence, I retired at 60, and it was sad, but pretty happy. I am set free to do what I want to do. And now is probably an interesting time. Just before this acquisition happened, I had a very interesting life experience. I had this syndrome called Guillain-Barré. I disease, whatever state to happen, was hospitalized for 40 days. Wow. And I was paralyzed, couldn't stand up and walk. And so I came out of that. And when I went back to work, after within the first week, the company announced it was being acquired. I'm like, oh, I've been through worse. I'm healthy. Yeah. I don't need to worry about this. So that was another kind of life-changing experience, because I was a bit of a workaholic. And while I still love to work, you know, time to think about other things and giving back. So we met in an interesting conversation once. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I liked helping people start it. So I have a large number of people who I mentor. And so I started in a small cap value shop, a place called Bitch and Tang. They were a hedge fund before there was a hedge fund. Mm. They were the kind of guys who would beat the S&P by a lot and have be only 75% invested and have a tremendous amount of cash. I guess I went to Columbia University and I got an MBA from NYU. And I guess the thing that's really interesting is I did show business for 10 years when I first came to New York.
Really?
Yeah. So, and I worked a good bit. I did West Side Story, the revival. I was in a nightclub act at the Rainbow Room.
And so wait, how are you involved in show
business? So I was a dancer.
Actually. No kidding.
No kidding. I'm a giant foot dancer, but I was a trickster. I like to jump and spin.
Huh.
And, you know, it was really a great training for Wall Street because it taught you not to believe the BS. And, you know, song, if you're in trouble, go into your song and dance. Don't let them shoot at you while you're standing still. So that was a great training for Wall Street. And then I went to Columbia and I got a lot of scholarship money through Columbia. Columbia University is near and dear to my heart. And then out of Columbia, I got hired in this extinct program where an accounting company hired me to go full time to school for the first summer and pay me a salary.
Mm.
So I went to school for the summer, full-time, part-time through the winter, full-time another summer, and I had an MS in accounting, and then I could get an MBA on my own nickel. So I got that, an MBA from NYU.
So how does one make the leap from literally dancing to investing? Like, that seems like those worlds are more than one degree of separation apart.
Yeah, Columbia was the connection. You know, I went to Columbia and I did well. I hadn't gone to school, so I
came to New York. Oh, so it wasn't like your MBA. This was your undergrad. Okay.
Yeah, and then I went to Columbia as an undergrad.
Nice.
And that was the, you know, and I worked hard. You know, fortunately, math was always a friend of mine, and standardized tests, I always read well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always, you know, easy peasy for me to kind of do well on. And mm-hmm. I was lucky. Columbia gave me a chance. And so that was, you know, then, you know, I wanted to be an investment banker, but I was definitely out of, and I didn't fit into that mold.
Uh-huh.
You know, they were looking for a specific type. I mean, you're 10 years older than everybody.
Yeah.
You're not going to fit in. But I got this job with PricewaterhouseCoopers, and you know, they sent me to get a degree and work, and it was a great experience.
Huh.
And from there, once I finished my MBA, I started an internship with this place, Rich and Tang, and they taught me. They're old school, old time investors, fantastic guys, super smart, always finding something new, looking for, and, you know, and kind of taught me my special sauce, which is free cash flow.
Mm.
So I think we've talked a little bit about this, but free cash flow is, I invest a lot like a PE guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at the price of free cash flow. So that's, probably a lot of people you speak to as a contrarian. Actually, I think that's one of the things that's really hard for contrarians to be, because you can't just do the opposite of everybody. You have to have some sort of grounding principle.
Right.
And that grounding principle is be cash or the valuation, but cash, you know, and so you can talk about Equitrans, what will the cash flow be, but you got to find your way to it. So
Interesting. All right. Wow. That's really interesting. Are you still involved in show business at all?
I am not.
Okay.
I'm cured.
Ah.
I have no desire, but, I do like, you know, I like to create a process. And so one of the things I find about this work is to create a process. I mean, I enjoy the game.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the game. It's just too much fun. That's why I kind of got to play.
Right.
I mean, I like to used to say, and it's still true. I mean, money is only the way you keep score.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing the game.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And unfortunately, GameStop has gamified, right? That's the game has serious consequences. Another game I used to like to play is when I was going to college at Columbia, I would ride my bike back and forth. I'd go to the college, go to the restaurant job and home again. And, you know, I'd be riding in traffic. It was the best game I ever played. Mm. And, you know, but you only get one guy. So if you get hit and wiped out, you're dead. So I love the game, but you got to understand the risks. So investing has a similar kind of a risk reward.
Mm.
Get wiped out, you're dead. So,
right.
You know, right. So unfortunately, a lot of people do not understand risk reward.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Right.
And that's why we have a silliness right now.
Yeah. 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 And probably too loose monetary policy and factoring in and, you know, this expectation that you get something for nothing and this gambler mindset, you know, there's a lot of things involved in that.
We talked a little earlier, and I wanted to touch base on this. We're trying to find what's the right metaphor for the period that we're in. And I mentioned the late 70s. And I think that also is a period where we had a big drop in 1973, 74. We had a popular president, Jimmy Carter, come in. And after a president who was unliked, unloved. And then all of a sudden, everything, the wheels came apart. We had rampant and wild inflation. And, you know, maybe that is a better model. I mean, things are different. Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of other issues.
Yeah.
But that's an era that we shouldn't forget because that's the last time we had inflation. Since then, it's been the great moderation. Mm. And interest rates since 1982 has been one way down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're about as close to zero as you could possibly get without going negative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, I mean, the real rates are negative, but the actual nominal rate is yet to go negative. And we follow Germany into that path.
We could if we need to. I mean, the Fed said they aren't afraid to try stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that hasn't worked out too well for Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, right. Yeah, and in the 70s, also, don't forget, we also had stagflation eventually, right? I mean, there was inflation without growth, right? And that was a horrible thing. And Volcker ended up, you know, just by jacking up interest rates to whatever it was, 10%.
Yep.
You know, hopefully, we won't have that. But is this well,
right? So you bring up a really good point. I actually met Volcker once. I was at some sort of dinner for Pfizer, and I'm the only guy who knows Paul Volcker. He's out there. Nobody's talking to him. He's a giant of a man. He's like 6'8". And I'm shaking his hand and I'm gushing. Oh, you saved us from inflation. How can I ever? I'm just blubbering, you know, nobody else, all these doctors, they could care less, but I blubber. Anyways, he did something quite unique and he turned the world on his head. Sort of like what Ben Bernanke did. And that we used to target interest rates and Volcker said, no, we're not going to target rates. We're just going to target the rate of growth of the money supply.
Right.
Interest rates go where they want. But we're going to have just steady increase in money supply and, you know, interest rates shot to the roof, but he killed and cured inflation. So we thought you brought up stagflation, which I think is a really interesting idea because Milton Friedman won a Nobel Prize for his explanation. And another guy did the same explanation who I studied with at Columbia was Edmund Phelps. I actually think Friedman had a better model, but the basic idea is we had these inflationary expectations built in and they're hard to break once you set them in, especially if cost of living adjustments for unions and inflations, right? We don't quite have the same model now. We don't have this same inflationary living wage expectation. Right. So that's one of the things why you couldn't have, we had the Phillips curve and the Phillips curve said you couldn't have inflation with unemployment. And we did have unemployment and we had stagflation. So that was through the, you know, so very important idea right now, because what we were touching in, how fast does the labor market heal? If the labor market heals quickly, you know, and we get to full employment relatively quick, which might be a big leap, then how do you slow the economy?
Mm-hmm. Well, you jack up rates. I mean, right? That's what Greenspan did eventually, and Bernanke.
Yeah.
I mean, Bernanke had a different, it wasn't just, that was a different, that was a housing bubble without much growth, but Greenspan certainly did in the early 2000s, right?
I mean, 2006, 2007, the short-term rate was 5.5%.
Yeah, he had jacked up that high. Yeah.
Think about that now. 5.5%, people would be dancing in the streets if you're a fixed income manager.
Yeah.
That's overnight money.
Right. Well, yeah, but that's one thing that the Fed has said is that they, and what people have said is that they've learned from that. Remember Bernanke, it was like every quarter, if I'm not mistaken, he raised it a quarter point, and it was like clockwork. Like if you look at the chart back then, it was just like a nice little thing.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, but which in retrospect turned out to be way too aggressive. So they say they've learned from that and they're not going to do it.
But we're fighting the last war.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So, which is, I'm not saying, certainly we're not going to have inflation, and anybody who's betting, you should bet that the market's going to go up in the near term. But I also am cognizant of the old saying, buy in the rumor, sell in the news. So the rumor is markets are going to go up. So we've had a rip-roaring market rally, and it was expensive before the pandemic, and it's now even more expensive with, earnings, low. I mean, in 2008, 2009, we had it's getting rich, but it wasn't way overvalued.
Mm-hmm.
We're way overvalued and the market's gone up and we still don't really have earnings recovering.
Right.
I mean, they've recovered incredibly fast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So does that mean we're due for another? I don't want to bet against what's happening in between fiscal and monetary policy. And I think one of the other things we have to really bring up here, which is hard to factor in, and if you're a contrarian investor, you should think about this, is the divide between Main Street and Wall Street.
Yeah.
There's people suffering. If you're a waiter, yeah. I mean, I waited tables through college. I mean, I wouldn't know how to survive this, I would be driving a truck from somewhere that, I'd find some place that nobody wanted to go to and I'd drive there,
Right.
But there's a suffering on Main Street that's different than what we on Wall Street have experienced.
Right.
And so how does that divide get healed? I don't know. I mean, I don't think fiscal policy is what we have right now. I mean, we're just throwing money at the problem. And, so part of the way we're fixing it is we're going to have some infrastructure projects, would be great because you get a return on investment. I mean, one of the problems we did in 2008 is that we threw money, but we didn't do projects that returned on investment. So the government spending multiplier, which all in Keynesian models, if it's less than one, so you spend a dollar, you don't get as much back. You get more than one, you get more back. So it's like a return on investment. So if you get 1.15 as a government multiplier, you're getting 15% return on your dollar. But consider the problem that we had in the great financial crisis. We didn't probably get a return on our dollar, or very low return.
Right.
So this time, do we get more of a return on our dollar?
We'll see. I mean, there would have to be some big infrastructure. I mean, that's a good point. Where did that money go? I mean, there wasn't much fiscal spending beyond, military. And I mean, they did do some stuff, some stimulus, I think. Fiscally in 08, 09, but most of it was on the monetary side. But now again, what are you going to do? Right. And, can you really have, the government's still pretty divided even with a Democratic president and Democrat Senate and House, but can you get something passed? That would be a big infrastructure bill? I don't know. Form would that take?
There's a lot of political questions. I mean, and there's certainly conservative Democrats. The senator from West Virginia is not, he votes, he's probably more comfortable as a Republican, but he's a legacy blue dog Democrat. Who knows with all that? I mean, certainly we need spending. I'm not saying not to spend, but what we spend on could make a difference and how we spend. And it's really, politics is, I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. So that's why I went to Wall Street, because I like honest greed.
Compared to Washington, yeah.
Yeah, that, this on a screen, I'm only thinking of you. So, you know, but so we have this divide, and so that's going to make a big difference how we get to inflation and non-inflation. And so there's a contrarian in me says, oh, it's going to be inflationary this time. But the contrarian in me says, it's, you know, it's also going to be different this time. So, I mean, but maybe it's not different. Maybe we have this problem that of unemployment that's going to be quite profound. Mm. And the difference between white collar workers and those who can't work on a machine like we are is going to be profound.
Yeah. Yeah. Rather a bit of a downer note there in the end. But, you know, for the short term, going back to, you know, financial markets, risk assets, you have to say that there are all signs are pretty much bullish. Would you agree?
Yep. Yep. And we're in the TINA world. So, you know, there is no alternative.
Right.
So the TINA world says, if you're managing money, like I work for an insurance company, and at one point, you know, there was 11 people managing $45 billion. Mm-hmm. And we could be responsible for a company of over 10,000 people, half the earnings. Right. So 11 people, 10,000 make half the earnings. That's when you had rates and you can make a difference.
Yeah.
Now you can't.
Right.
So anybody who has pensions, insurance assets, which is one of the reasons why we're seeing the rise of different entities like private equity and CLOs, because, you know, CLOs, you know, which, and then there's all sorts of these new banking assets. What banks used to do have now become under like private equity and CLO managers. And so there's a whole new level of risk in that world. There's places where it makes a tremendous amount of sense. I love business development corporations that make first lien loans to private equity guys, but you have a solid position. But if you're a high yield manager, you're way at the tail of all of that. And CLOs that are buying all these other crazy pieces of debt, they're just kind of what used to be in 2008, you know, buying up the residual piece and hoping that, you know, the law of big numbers were, you know, but if you're getting lots of crap and you're piling it in saying it's actually not crap, you know, it's still crap, you know.
We saw that in 2008 also with the mortgage-backed securities, remember, right? I mean,
exactly, the residuals. You need to take
a lot of those, but a lot of those were rated AAA, which is a whole nother story, but yeah.
Yeah, we can go a long way on that one.
Yeah.
I mean, but again, we kind of have that. We touched on this with ESG, having one number like AAAs, right? There was three levels of AAA. There was super duper AAA, just super AAA, and then old fashioned AAA. But that was probably more like barely investment grade, maybe not. You know, so yeah, it's people trying not to do your work. You have to do your work.
Yeah. So can't create something out of nothing, right? All right, cool. Leo Schmidt, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. Maybe in closing, tell our listeners how they can find out more about you. You are not on the social media.
I am not, but I am. I'm a committee chair at the CFA Society.
Right, which is where we met, right.
Where we met. Yeah. I'm Institutional Asset Management Committee Chair. Last year, I happened to be the Volunteer of the Year. I won the Volunteer of the Year Award, which means I'm the biggest sucker of the year. And
I was going to say that's something for your ESG.
I'm the biggest sucker. I have a small group of clients, and so I'm not really looking for more.
Okay, fair enough. But at the CFA Society of New York, which is a great organization, by the way, that, and you obviously pre-COVID, you had these events in person, and now you do some over Zoom, right?
We do a lot over Zoom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a tremendous, it's almost exploding the amount of content we've been able to do because you don't have to travel. I had a nice event in the end of January called New Year Market Outlook. Had some really fantastic people, somebody from BlackRock, somebody from Lord Abbott, which was our sponsor. We had somebody from AllianceBernstein, Shalaya Khan, who's fantastic. Yeah. And I was doing this, I'm blanking at the moment. Anyways, we had a really great round table speaking. And this morning there was a nice round table seeking alpha in China. I mean, we do something almost every day. If viewers are interested, past events you can often see online.
Yeah.
So you don't have to, the current, you know, with, so we usually put it on 2 weeks after
the
event. So you don't get the most current version, but if you want to take a look at something historic, it's possible.
Yeah.
And it's great content.
And that website is cfainstituteny.com. Is that it?
No, it's CFA Society New York.
Right. CFA Society New York, one word. All right, I'll look it up and put it in the show notes for sure.
Yeah.
Very good. All right, Leo, thank you again so much for joining us. Thank you all for listening. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.